The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 6, The Importance of Environment in the Short Term.
I'd like to begin this lecture, which will cover various topics relevant to the effect of environment on genetics, with a wonderful experiment that was begun in the 1950s in Russia that had many wonderful serendipitous results, very exciting results. And this is an ongoing experiment and one that we continue to understand more and more about the complexity of these pathways from. Goes like this. In the 1950s, in Russia, Soviet Russia at the time, there was a decision to experiment with the steps of domestication and to choose a canine that had not yet been domesticated. Rather than starting with wolves, which is what our human ancestors began with thousands of years ago, and thus came all of the wonderful breeds of dogs that we have, the idea was, let's try a canine that has not been domesticated, about which we don't know much, about which domestication is something of a mystery, and let's see how many steps it takes to get a domestic animal. They chose silver foxes. And in fact, I think this experiment was associated with a silver fox fur farm. So they had an abundance of silver foxes ready to go, but none of them especially domesticated, all of them with wild temperaments. And temperament is the key word there. They were really experimenting with temperaments. They were not going out of their way to experiment with any other aspect of the silver fox domestication process. So here's what they did. They selected for the tamest silver foxes that they could in each new generation of new pups. They were looking for calm silver foxes. They were looking for placid ones. They were looking for ones that would come forward in an obsequious way, maybe with their heads down and maybe act a little playful in the presence of a human as opposed to standing off and looking hostile as maybe a wolf might. In short, they were doing what you might do if you were choosing a new puppy for your family, or if you were at the animal shelter looking at adult dogs and trying to decide, you know, what dog might fit with your family. They were looking for behaviors that we tend to associate with domestic animals. What the big surprise was how quickly they were able to develop a domestic strain of foxes. And strain is the word I'll use here, or variety is another word that could be used here. It's not a different species from the silver foxes, but it's definitely a different variety of silver foxes based on their behavior. How few were the generations to get to a point where you would begin to say, this is a domesticated canine. This canine is on its way to what wolves were on their way to being, at least some of them thousands of years ago when they began the lineage of what we know as dogs. But here's the additional surprise to give you an idea of how complicated and wonderful this is. Without trying, without making any effort whatsoever, the silver foxes that were becoming domesticated in respect to their behaviors were also coming up with the most peculiar coat colors, including a coat color called piebald, which I didn't actually mention in words in the previous lecture, but which is essentially a black and white coat color, alternating markings of black and white. You're getting that from the S-series genes. They were getting curly tails. Imagine that in a fox, a curly tail. They were getting floppy ears. Again, imagine that in a silver fox. No longer pointy, alert ears, but floppy ears. They were beginning to get pushed-in puppy faces. You know how when puppies are first born, no matter what their adult faces are going to look like, this is true for humans too, of course, you have kind of a much flatter face with the eyes looking a little more forward and the nose not quite as elongated. And then whatever that dog is going to end up looking like, the nose can elongate and the eyes can change in respect to the shape of the face. So that's one amazing thing that they noticed. The other thing is that they began to get changes in the rate of maturity of the silver foxes. They began to get changes in the reproductive cycles of their silver foxes. And most importantly, they finally decided they needed to use this word for what was going on. The word is wonderful. The word is neoteny, N-E-O-T-E-N-Y, and it means the retention of juvenile characteristics in an adult. And it's actually an extremely important concept in not only domestication, but in genetics in general. It suggests a number of things. First of all, selecting for one trait, which you might think would be a fairly simple, straightforward thing, had come along with it all sorts of other traits. And secondly, changing the way an animal reproduces and matures can have profound effects on the way that it interacts with other animals. Many breeds of dogs have neoteny, are neotenous, have retained juvenile characteristics. Not all. There are plenty of dogs that actually retain a real wolf-like look about them and retain some wolf-like behaviors, but many, many, many dogs, I'm thinking of many of the toy breeds and miniature breeds, certainly any dog with a face that has become pushed in a little bit, not elongated anymore, whose ears have become floppy, whose tail has become short and curly, is neotenous. And certainly any dog that has the behaviors of a puppy, yipping and nipping and playing and rolling over on the back, none of which are adult wolf-like behaviors. Absolutely none of those are adult behaviors in a wolf. Those are dogs that are neotenous. So the real exciting surprise here was just how powerful even something like this could be in really transforming the entire domesticated animal, all the way to including something that seems as superficial as a coat color. Remember, these dogs came up with sort of black and white spots, or these silver foxes. I'm going to recommend a paper for this chapter. I'd like you to actually access the original review paper on this. It's not the original scientific paper, but a wonderful review paper, because I think you'd like to read a little bit more about it and actually get a look at some of the pictures of these silver foxes just a few generations away from being adults. The other thing I want you to recall about that piebald trait, that black and white trait, is I said that it was the S series of alleles that could cause it. And I said that if you watch the S series of alleles in action, remember they're starting their activities along the backbone of the animal, and then they're proceeding down to color or not color the rest of the animal, depending on which S alleles you've got. You're getting stripes, you're getting spots, you're getting a dark dorsal or upper part of the body, you're getting a lighter under part of the body, all the different variations you can get all the way to extreme white. Remember I said that these S genes are pretty powerful, and they're also associated with the migration of neurons from the backbone area during development, during the part of the embryonic development in which all kinds of important events are going on. So it points to this being not simply a case of looking at pigments, but really looking at something that's much more deeply meaningful if we're trying to understand the behavior of dogs. So there's a great deal more to be sorted out in this experiment, which, by the way, is still ongoing on a small scale. Begun in the 1950s, but from what I understand, there's still some part of this experiment that's ongoing. They're still working with these silver foxes and trying to understand even more about them. My next example is one of my favorite examples that I like to bring up if I'm talking to people about the importance of environment, because it is one of the most straightforward of examples that you could take as a metaphor for maybe other examples that maybe are less straightforward, ones that are more difficult to dissect. But remember, when we're talking about animal coat colors, I'm really using that metaphorically to represent all sorts of other pathways that are a little harder to get a look at. Now, this concerns the C series genes. Recall that we looked at the C series of genes just inside of the cell that was going to contain the pigment. After A, K, and E got done with what they were doing, we got inside of the cell, and there were the C series of genes that were going to give us either one pathway or another. And at that point, I alluded to there being a bit more complicated than just giving us one of two pathways. And indeed, there are quite a number of different pathways that can come from the C series of genes, including some pathways that lead to the making of neurotransmitters, by which neurons talk to each other, and other important molecules that are going to be used by the nervous system. So it's a real sort of a pivotal crossroad kind of a gene where we're either making pigments or we're making some extremely important parts of the nervous system. But there's more. It turns out that the C gene product, which is an enzyme, of course, all these little machines every step along the way are essentially enzymes, is susceptible to behaving differently according to temperature. And what we say about that is when an enzyme has a particular temperature optimum range, and pretty much all of them do, we might notice differences if we raise the temperature or lower the temperature. We might notice differences in activity. Now, how come we're not noticing this all the time? Well, oftentimes there's a fairly wide range of temperatures that an enzyme might work at. It's not a real pinpoint, tiny, optimal range. It's a fairly wide range. And also, remember, in mammals, there's a certain body temperature that's typically maintained. So even though there's a slight variations there, our enzymes are all working somewhere in the range where their temperature optimum is found. So here's maybe an exception. C-series alleles or C-series genes change their activity if temperatures get cooler. Let me use a particular example here, Siamese cats and some variations on Siamese cats. So visualize a Siamese cat. We're talking about an animal with a relatively pale body, could be a cream-colored body or a gray or a silvery body, but the extremities of the cat are dark. The ears, the tail, the paws, the nose, the face, the legs, and that coloring can change during the life of a cat, which you might not realize unless you've seen Siamese kittens going through their changes as they become adults. But those colorings of those extremities can actually change, become more extensive, become darker, or become lighter. According to what? According to temperature. So here's what's going on. If we have big C, full strength big C, we get a full-colored animal. That means we head down the pathway that gets us to eumelanin or pheomelanin. So that's, we've already covered that, and that's not what we're talking about here. It's when we get into the other versions of C. There's a C version that gives us Burmese cats. There's a C version that gives us Siamese cats. And there's a really extreme version of C that gives us albinos. And there's a number of different levels of albinos. There are albinos with regular melanin pigmented eyes, and then there are albinos that have no pigment in their eyes, pink-eyed albinos. And if you want to think about rodents here, that would be a good idea, because one of the things about cat and dog breeders is that for various reasons, a pink-eyed albino has never really been an important aesthetic goal for either of those groups of breeders. However, laboratory rodents are very often that extreme albino version with pink eyes. And you also probably know that there are versions of this in humans. Humans can be albino, and they can be either an extreme version or a less extreme version. It's the same allele series working in humans who are albinos. Other words for this phenomenon, by the way, besides connecting it with Siamese cats, is that it's sometimes called a Himalayan phenomenon, Himalayan as in the Himalayan mountains. And there are some dogs that show this particular trait. Now, what would you look for in a dog? You'd be looking for a dog with a relatively pale body color, and the ears, the tips of the nose, the paws, the tails, the extremities are going to be darker. Same thing with rodents. You'd be looking for rodents with extremities that were darker. And you might also be looking for changes in color as the animal ages. That would be another sign of this particular set of alleles at work. Now, are your ears colder than the rest of your body? Yes. If you touch your ears, you can actually feel they're a little colder. Is the tip of your nose colder than the rest of your body? It sure is. Touch the tip of your nose. Tips of your fingers colder than the rest of your body? Yes, they are. Tips of your toes. And if you had a tail, would the tip of your tail be colder? Yes, it would be. So what's going on is actually very straightforward. There is a variation in temperature from one place to another of the body. Many of your enzymes don't have any particular reaction to that that's significant that we can observe. But in this case, these particular enzymes that are being produced by the C series of alleles do indeed have this reaction. Now, I suspect some people might be thinking, would this possibly be the explanation for why some babies are born with very pale hair colors? And they're certainly born with pale eye colors. I mean, generally, blue eyes is a baby trait in most mammals. So would this possibly be the case here? Yes, but I will say that it's more difficult to work with human genetics. It's much easier to experiment with rodents and dogs, so there is not a lot of work to solidly connect that aspect of human hair color up to this exact C series of alleles here. So I would just say it's a hypothetical connection, but I'm not comfortable with making it a firmer connection without additional information about that. I noticed the Himalayan phenomenon in rodents. As a child growing up on a farm, I was allowed to have guinea pigs, and for various reasons, I was allowed to have as many guinea pigs as I wanted. In other words, they were allowed to reproduce. And I got a great deal of pleasure in seeing all the wonderful coat colors that came out of the guinea pig matings, none of which I tried to orchestrate, but I was often aware of who the parents were and puzzled over what the coat colors were like. And years later, now that I understand a little bit about the C series of alleles and how this Himalayan coat color can come about, this one that I've just been talking about, I realize that it explains something that I used to notice. At the height of the summer, I might have 12 or 15 guinea pigs. And then as winter went along, I would end up selling some of them to pet stores for about $3 a piece and taking a few guinea pigs over the winter to, you know, be in the house. They had a wonderful outdoor environment for the summertime. As we got into the days of fall, my perfectly white guinea pigs from summertime would often darken up their ears and their noses and their paws. Guinea pigs don't have much in the way of tails, so I didn't observe darkening of tails, but I must say that I was puzzled as to why my guinea pigs, especially my white guinea pigs, would be changing color as the season changed. And now that's one of the mysteries that has been solved now that I'm an adult and teaching genetics. So far we have been talking about environment, and so far it's been mostly equated with temperature, which I think is not a bad starting place. I mean, it's a pretty easy way to start thinking about environment, just simply thinking about changes in temperature. But what I'd like to do next is add some nuances to what we mean by environment, especially if we're going to try to understand it in a genetics context, which is the goal here. I'm going to start with the most obvious image that might come to a lot of people's minds when I say environment, and then I'm going to dismiss that fairly quickly, and we're going to move on to maybe some other more unusual aspects of environment. If you were thinking air and water and pollutants and nutrition as your first cut on environment, that's fine. That's a typical thing, and that's at the top of my list. In other words, what's the air quality like? What's the water quality like? Are there any pollutants in it? Are there any potentially disease-causing elements in there? What's the nutrition of the animal like? And certainly all of those are important for environment. And certainly all of those can come up in discussion if we're trying to talk about a particular pathway of genes and really fully understand it. We really need to ask about those things. But I quickly want to get down to a different level. Our bodies are environments unto themselves, various temperatures, as we've just pointed out with that other set of genes, but with all sorts of other nuances as well. The outside of our bodies are dry. The insides of our bodies are wet. There are some parts of the body getting more blood than others. There are some parts of the body in which muscles are very responsive and other parts of the body with no muscles at all. So our bodies are environments with great diversity. Our organs are environments in which genes act or don't act. Our tissues are environments. The environment inside of a cell is also important. A gene is inside of a cell, and it is very often sensitive to what that cell is all about, what sort of things are being produced in that cell, what sort of things are being packaged up, transported in that cell. So I think of the cell as an environment for our genes. I think of all sorts of, going back to the outside of the organism now, all sorts of interactions with other organisms as part of the environment. For example, interactions with our own species tend to, change our hormonal levels, change our neuron activity, and all of that changes the general environment in which genes are used. So interactions with our own species, but then how about interactions with other species? How about our interactions with our pets, including how we might raise a pet or how a pet might influence the way our household is run? How about interactions with tiny organisms like bacteria, which are absolutely filling our bodies and actually far outnumber our cells? How about all of our interactions with those? And then how about our interactions with viruses? And then getting into a really nuanced aspect of this that's terribly important, a newly fertilized egg that is going to become an embryo very soon is an environment unto itself and an extremely important one. And then the in utero environment, the environment in which that egg, in which that embryo is going to develop, is extremely important. Where the placenta is and how extensively that is developed and where the embryo is in respect to that and where it might be in respect to other embryos that might also be in utero. And then, of course, we have to go back out to the environment again. What's the nutrition of the mother? What are her interactions that might make slight changes in that in utero environment for however long the embryo is going to be there? And it's important because remember I said that a lot of the really crucial major genetic changes are occurring in the embryonic stage. When we talked about those melanin-producing genes, when we talked about the connection with the neurons and when all that migration was going on, I kept saying this is happening in the embryo. So it's also happening within the environment of the uterus, which in turn is within the environment of a woman, which in turn is in the environment that she finds herself in. That means, and here's our ongoing topic, or what I would like to be our ongoing topic for this course. What should we be thinking about clones? When we first talked about clones, I said, let's first of all make sure whether we're talking about plants or animals, because there really is a big difference. But let's zero in on animals. Let's zero in on mammals. And in fact, let's zero in on the whole question of if I would like to have a clone of my beloved dog, who will be deceased, let's say, sometime in the next couple of weeks, and if I take a sample from that dog's tissue so that I have a few of that dog's cells and send it off to one of the new pet cloning companies, here's what's going to happen to it. They're going to take the nucleus containing all of the DNA from that beloved dog of mine, and they're going to implant it into a newly fertilized dog egg from a surrogate mother. Okay? Then, probably using a different surrogate mother dog, they're going to implant that newly fertilized egg that now contains the nucleus containing the DNA of my beloved pet into the uterus of another surrogate mother dog. So already we've got two new major environments introduced to the DNA of my pet dog. We've got the newly fertilized egg environment. We've got the in utero environment. So I'm going to leave you with that thought for now. We'll pick this up later. Ongoing theme here is to think more and more about clones. But at this point, I want to leave you with the thought. So in what ways have I truly cloned my pet, assuming that I would like to do that? And in what ways have I perhaps not cloned my pet? Or in what ways are there going to be some really delicate but important differences between the original dog and whatever pet that I might get as a result of doing this? Oh, and by the way, that's not even saying anything about what I do with my pet once it arrives back to my house having been cloned. Do I have to raise it in precisely the same way, the same training, the same food, the same all the aspects that you think of with a pet? But I actually think the in utero and in egg environment is really where some very, very important things happen. And it's things to think about as more and more we talk about cloning of mammals. Remember, these issues scarcely come up with the cloning of plants, but with the cloning of mammals, these are things to be thinking about. So here's something that occasionally comes up if you're chatting with people, say at a cocktail party, and you get into this discussion of nature versus nurture. nature being the genes that an organism has and nurture being the environment. And often it will be something topical in the news in which you're doing your best to sort out, well, to what extent is it genetic? To what extent is it environmental? Here's a new word for you to introduce into that discussion. Predisposition. Predisposition is a much better word. And in fact, I would say that nature versus nurture is a false dichotomy, and that you should say so. I mean, if someone says, is trying to pin you down to it's either nature or nurture, I think the correct response to that is we're not talking about a two-sided coin here. We're not talking about an either-or possibility. We're talking about something much more intricate and much more complicated, and that's when you introduce this word predisposition. I think you could say, for example, my Siamese cat is predisposed to having black extremities. When? Well, if the cat is exposed to cooler temperatures than other cats. Or my family is predisposed to high blood pressure, meaning that I've got the set of genes that often results in high blood pressure, but it's not a guaranteed thing because we're complicated, because there are many other environmental aspects. Or you could say, that breed of dog is often predisposed to dominant behaviors. Or you could say, the separated identical twins seem to have been predisposed to having anxieties, but one was raised in a calm environment and the other in a hectic environment. Separated identical twins, there are lots of very famous studies from decades ago, mostly in which identical twins in orphanages were adopted to different families, and then in some cases, studies were done later to see to what extent traits were matching and to what extent traits were different. So I'm referring to those separated identical twin studies, of which there are actually quite a few in the literature. But I think predisposition is really the word you want to interject there and not make it just a simple two-way dichotomy. Here's another thing I want to caution you about if you're talking about this in discussing some news of the day in genetics. Beware of naming of genes. I'm going to have a whole section on naming of genes, but here's my first warning about beware of the naming of genes. If someone talks about the math gene or the gene for alcoholism or the gene for genius in math, that's the point at which recall your cycle, your pathways, recall the cookie factory. There are no genes that deserve to be called the gene, and certainly no genes in those complicated pathways that deserve to be singled out in that particular way, the alcoholism gene or the math gene. And always remember the single gene fallacy as well. These genes are interacting with many others, and just because you've discovered one gene doesn't mean you've discovered anything about the rest of the pathway. That said, I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit here with a little more on the genetics of behavior and tell you about some studies that were done with a gene, not the gene, a gene that is involved with the way we use our neurotransmitters. And it is a gene that seems to be in a complicated pathway, some aspects of which control our tendency to be either very anxious or very calm. Okay, so let's say those are two, you know, ways of, that people could be. You could break it down into those two categories. The name of the gene is monoamine oxidase, sometimes abbreviated MAO, and I'm mentioning that in case you want to look it up. What it does is it breaks down various neurotransmitters. Now, neurotransmitters are small molecules that neurons pass from one to another, like little messages. It's how neurons communicate. But if you imagine yourself communicating with little yellow post-it notes, once you're done with that communication, you want to tear up the post-it note and recycle it. You don't want to have that post-it note lying around saying repeatedly, buy more milk, buy more milk, buy more milk. Once the milk is done, you want to tear up the post-it note and be done with it. So what the monoamine oxidase genes do is produce a product that breaks down those little signaling molecules. Apparently, if those signaling molecules are not broken down efficiently, it can result in anxious sorts of behaviors, sometimes resulting in more aggressive behaviors and sometimes involved with more of what psychologists call risk-taking behaviors. Now, here's what I would be careful about. Any study that declares the MAO genes or the monoamine oxidase genes to be the warrior gene. See, there's a word that you don't want to use for that because that has all kinds of implications. You don't want to call that the warrior gene. And it really takes away from the complexity of this and makes it sound like a very simple and single-minded sort of gene. You absolutely want to consider the environment. And you know this if you know dogs. You can have a dog that's a little bit anxious but brought up in a calm family, or a dog that's a little bit aggressive but that has that trained out of him so that it's not a problem. So environment is always there. And always be thinking in terms of pathways and allele series. But that said, don't be afraid of looking into it either. One of the things that has happened in some aspects of looking into the genetics of behavior is extreme caution, lest we go too far down a path of naming something in drawing conclusions. I think don't be afraid of looking at it either, and don't be afraid of examining it further. And let me give you some examples of the sorts of things that people are doing that I think are really interesting experiments. There have been produced in laboratories, and this is strictly a laboratory kind of thing, what are called knockout mice for monoamine oxidase, or MAO. What that means is these are mice that have had their genes for monoamine oxidase completely incapacitated. It's a major undertaking in a laboratory. These are very valuable mice. And now you've got a sort of a ready-made experiment in the cookie factory. It's like you've gone in deliberately to knock out the dough-making machine. And now you can stand back and ask what happens. I mean, in a very, very specific way. So knockout mice, very, very valuable. What happens to knockout mice for MAO or monoamine oxidase? They have an increase in neurotransmitters. That makes sense, right? And they have an increase in anxiety behaviors. And the reason these are pretty reliable results is because these mice are all as identical as the human researchers can make them. They're in a laboratory. They're all being treated absolutely identically. And so they can be compared in a more exact way to a group of control mice that have not had this happen. You might be wondering whether anyone has investigated this in dogs, because certainly dogs can be anxious or aggressive in some cases, or to have other sorts of interesting behaviors. And there are indeed some studies underway. Now, nobody's doing knockout dog genes, as far as I know. But what they are doing are taking individual breeds of dogs and taking a look to see which version of the genes for various neurotransmitter regulators, of which this MAO is one. And they're asking, what version do you have and what kind of differences are we finding? So just for fun, I'll tell you what dogs they've looked into, because I know you're curious about this. Rottweilers, Labrador Retrievers, Newfoundlands, Golden Retrievers, English Setters, Boxers, Norwegian Lundehounds, and German Shepherds. Here's the caveat, though. When you read about a study like this, and it's the sort of study that could get into the popular press because it's really interesting stuff, know that they looked at one individual dog from each of those categories, and they definitely found differences in the genes for the monoamine oxidases, but that's it. Okay, so the real discussion is what should they do next? And what they should do next is do 100 Rottweilers and 100 Labrador Retrievers and do them under all different circumstances. So the important thing is to not leave these topics dangling with misunderstandings, but rather pursue them to the logical ends. Now, I'm going to close this lecture by saying that a very interesting thing happened to contrast with the other Russian study that we talked about, the wonderful study with the silver foxes. Very unfortunate thing happened around this topic in Soviet Russia under Stalin. And that is, for various reasons, for various political agendas, and according to various programs that were going along in Stalinist Russia at that time, genetics became a forbidden topic. And there became a sort of a demand from the government that only environment be taken into consideration with their breeding programs for animals and especially for plants. And it's a sort of an interesting mix of politics and science with the result that for a while, genetics in Soviet Russia was really held back because of this policy that we could only examine environment and not examine genetics at all. Later, we'll talk about eugenics and see the other extreme in which government policies can dictate the opposite situation. And it's an interesting sort of contrast. In general, politics and science don't always mix well, especially when there's a political agenda. Now, in this next lecture, I'm going to talk about some more long-term effects of environment. We're going to continue with environment, but I'm going to talk about it on a larger scale.
This ends Lecture 6.